This is Barron's Live. Each week, we bring you live conversations from our newsrooms about what's moving the market right now. On this podcast, we take you inside those conversations, the stories, the ideas, and the stocks to watch so you can invest smarter. Now, let's dial in.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Barron's Live, our weekly webcast and podcast. I'm Lauren Rublin, Senior Managing Editor of Barron's. Thanks for joining us today for a look at the markets and a discussion of asset allocation. My guests are Barron's Deputy Editor Ben Levison and Ben Inker, co-head of asset allocation at the money management firm GMO. Welcome, Ben and Ben. I don't know how I'm going to keep you straight today.
Thanks, Lauren.
I'm very happy to have you both on Barron's Live.
Happy to be here.
Thanks, Lauren.
Fantastic. So, Ben Inker, judging from today's listener questions, which I can see and you can't, our subscribers are keenly interested in the subject of asset allocation. Before we get there, however, I want to talk about the market's odd behavior today and how investors should think about a possible escalation of the war in the Middle East. Of course, that was the big weekend news. Stocks mounted a relief rally this morning after it became apparent that Iran's attack on Israel had largely failed to cause damage, but now stocks have given back most of those gains. I think the takeaway, if nothing else, is that geopolitical concerns are going to be with us for quite a while, and they're bigger than they had been. So, Ben Inker, what are you watching on the geopolitical front at the moment, and how do you interpret the market's action?
Well, I am with you on the kind of assumption about what the market has been doing today. I thought the rally this morning was a little bit surprising to me. Stocks up, bonds down, crude oil down. That was a strong relief, or it looked like a strong relief after what was, you know, a pretty significant attack by Iran, albeit one that was successfully kind of thwarted.
Yeah.
I mean, geopolitically, there is a lot to worry about these days, right? We've got the Mideast, we have the Ukraine, we have that always sitting out there question of, is China ever going to do anything to Taiwan? There's a lot to be worried about. The frustrating thing about geopolitical stuff is it's very difficult to study. One of the things we have found is that pundits tend to do a lousy job of forecasting things because so many geopolitical events are one-offs. So it is the kind of thing we are always worried about. We are seldom doing much about. And that's a frustrating position to be in. It would be great to say, aha, I know what's going to happen and I know how to respond to it. I will say, one of the things I've learned across my career is even if I had, you know, the crystal ball knowing what was going to happen, I would still get it wrong about half the time in terms of how the market is going to react to it. I would not have guessed the stock market would have opened up approximately 1%, you know, the first trading day after Iran sends 300 missiles and drones to Israel. But it did.
Right. No, I agree with you. It is very hard to know the future, but how should an investor be thinking about this, given all the uncertainties? Should we just ignore it? Should we keep it on in the background? Does it affect how you invest?
You know, in times of significant uncertainty, one thing we always want to make sure we have is a decent amount of liquidity available to react if something really extreme happens in markets. The tricky thing is when events are occurring and the markets are ignoring them, lots of times that's because the market is right. And sometimes it's because the market is not paying attention the way it should. So the one thing we know to do at a time of uncertainty is make sure we've got liquidity available. But we it is difficult if you say, ooh, it's uncertain. There are bad things that might happen. Let me take down my allocation to stocks or other risky assets.
Well, you'd be forever taking it down in that case.
Exactly.
So, Ben Levison, I want to ask you the same question. The Iran attack wasn't the only thing investors digested this morning. We also had a strong retail sales number, and we're gearing up for more second quarter earnings this week, which we will discuss shortly. The 10-year bond topped 4.65% earlier today, although it has retreated since then. What's on your horizon? What are you watching?
Well, what I find fascinating is that you have this, the stock market seems to be stuck in a not great place between one, you have the geopolitics where you get your traditional kind of risk off reaction where bond yields go down as people buy bonds, the stock market sells off. But then you also have these worries about the Fed. And what's going to happen with rates? And is the economy too strong? Is inflation going up too much? And you sort of get kind of an opposite reaction where yields go up. And I think that's what we saw today with retail sales. Retail sales were strong. Revisions to previous months, which had been weak, were revised up. So now they look strong as well. And that sent the 10-year yield up higher. But that's also not great for stocks when we're worried that maybe the Fed, you know, we've gone from, you know, possibly having three rate cuts to maybe having no rate cuts, or you know, some people are even out there saying maybe we need to hike again at some point. And so you end up with, I think, a stock market that gets sort of stuck between these two things, neither of which are very good for them. The one saving grace is, as always, is earnings. You know, how are they going to play out? And if they're as strong as, you know, analysts expect them to be, then the market might be able to climb that wall of worry there. But it's not a fun place to be in.
I'm getting that feeling, to be sure. So in that case, let's move on to asset allocation. And Ben Inker, I want to start with the basics here. Do you have an optimal allocation today? And if so, what is it?
So I don't think there is any single optimal asset allocation in the sense that you better have the right asset allocation for the problem you are trying to solve. If you've got money that you are going to be needing in the next year or two, you should really be taking less risk than you would be for retirement money you're not going to need in 20 or 30 years. I will say, you know, we run a strategy which we call benchmark free, and that one is designed around trying to achieve inflation plus 5% in the long run, which is kind of what people need for inflations or what an endowment or foundation needs to achieve today. And right now in that portfolio, we've got a little bit over half of our money in equities. We've got about a third of the money in alternative strategies, which are things like merger arbitrage, global macro, kind of hedge fundy type strategies, which have this nice advantage that the starting return is a T-bill, and T-bills yield a lot more than they have before. And then we've got about 12, 13% of the money in kind of traditional bonds. And within those equities, we are definitely biased against the U.S. We have more of our money outside of the U.S. than in the U.S.
And why is that?
Well, because the valuations are just a lot lower and the dollar has been really strong. And the reason why that matters is that strong dollar has led the dollar to look pretty expensive versus the euro or, say, the yen. The yen in particular is looking cheaper than it has in over 50 years. And that turns out to be a lovely thing for companies who have their costs in those currencies. If you are a Japanese company right now, Japanese wages are not even that much higher than Chinese wages in kind of cross-currency perspective. So this is a lovely time to be a Japanese company. Your growth is going to be better and your profit margins are going to be better because you have that really undervalued currency. So we see undervalued currencies, we see cheaper stock markets, and that gets us pretty excited. We can see a lot of stocks today that we think are cheap in absolute terms.
I'm going to come back to Japan in a moment, but what about emerging markets broadly, emerging market debt and equity? What do you think of that?
You know, the valuations look pretty compelling there on at least a relative basis. Emerging market debt, we quite like within credit. Corporate credit spreads in the U.S. have really tightened. The market is assuming there's going to be very few defaults in U.S. corporate land. And we always get a little bit nervous when the market gets confident on that front. And so we think you're getting paid more for a given amount of credit risk in emerging debt than you are in U.S. corporate debt. On the equity side of things, the valuations look just fine. And we can find a bunch of cheap stuff to own. The geopolitical risks do start to matter. You know, the question of how much of your portfolio you want to have in China is a difficult one to answer. China looks pretty cheap. But on the other hand, there are some tail risks that could really make it very difficult for US-based investors owning Chinese equities.
Are you investing in China as part of your strategies?
We are. We've limited the amount we're prepared to invest in China. We own more of the rest of emerging. About half of our holdings in emerging are explicitly ex-China. So that is anything but China from a stock perspective. So we do own some amount of China. It's maybe 2.5% of the overall portfolio.
But it's not a huge bet.
Yeah.
So going back to Japan for a moment, I know that you are fans of small cap value stocks. Tell me a little bit more about the play there.
Yeah. So there's a number of things to like about the small cap companies in Japan. One of them, as I said, that cheap currency is a real benefit for them. And it's probably a bigger benefit for the Japanese small caps than it is for the large caps. If you think about the household names, you know, the Toyotas of this world, Toyota builds cars all over the world. They build more cars in Japan than anywhere else. So that cheap yen does help. But a cheap yen is not as big a deal for a multinational based in Japan than it is for a smaller cap company that may have all of its production in Japan. So they have that benefit that they're probably bigger beneficiaries of the undervalued currency. They also tend to look cheaper. There's been a very nice rally in Japan over the last 18 months. But that has been very much a large cap rally. In general, it's been the names that the foreigners know that have done the best. So small cap companies are trading at a very significant discount to their larger cap brethren. The other thing we quite like about Japanese small caps is if we look over the last decade, they have done a lot of very difficult things to improve their businesses. So if we go back to 2000, well, really any time before about 2012, and you looked at Japanese companies, they had kind of half the profit margin of the rest of the world. So they really weren't making very much money. Over the last decade, they have done a lot of hard work kind of rebuilding their companies, getting rid of underperforming divisions, laying off people for kind of the first time in Japanese history. They have done a lot of unpleasant but necessary things. And that's really improved their returns. The one thing they haven't done yet is fix their balance sheets. The strange thing about Japan is Japan has the lowest interest rates in the world and has for a very long time, and some of the least levered companies anywhere.
Boy, that seems like a mismatch.
It really does, right? If you think about it, interest rates in Japan have been close to zero for over 20 years, and the average Japanese company has spent that time paying down their debt. That has really been a bit of a waste. Right. If you're if you're paying off debt that yielded one, the return on capital of that investment wasn't very high. it does mean they are now really pretty high quality companies. Their return on capital has gotten a lot higher, and they are not going to be dragged into bankruptcy by creditors because they don't really have any creditors anymore. What they need now is actually to start taking on a little bit of debt. And the nice thing is the Japanese government is actually encouraging this. They are pushing Japanese companies to buy back their own stock. They are pushing Japanese companies to do mergers. They are pushing Japanese companies to get their valuations and their return on capital higher. And it is a really nice thing when the government is on your side as an investor. It doesn't normally feel that way. In most countries, most of the time, but in Japan right now, the government is squarely behind you as an investor. And that seems like a nice tailwind to have.
Certainly beats the alternative.
Absolutely.
So I just want to mention, I know that you invest in individual companies, which you can't mention here, but Ben has come up with a couple of interesting ETFs for those interested in investing further in small cap Japanese stocks. One is the iShares MSCI Japan Small Cap ETF. The ticker symbol is SCJ. It's got 125 million in assets under management and yields 1%. And the other name is WisdomTree Japan Small Cap Dividend ETF. The ticker there is DFJ. It's got 247 million in assets and a 2% dividend yield. So thank you, Ben, for doing the legwork on that.
And actually, I have a question for Ben, if you don't mind, Lauren. You know, for the listeners at home, I mean, is using an ETF for small caps, do you think that's an okay way to do it if, you know, they don't want to go into a fund or something like that, if they just want to sort of do their asset allocation at home?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, the nice thing about the ETFs, those ETFs seem like they're probably pretty broad portfolios. And if what you're seeing is an opportunity for a kind of broad group of stocks, an ETF is a decent way of doing that. I quite like the cheaper companies within the small cap universe, which might be a little bit harder to get at in an ETF. But honestly, the average Japanese small cap company is pretty cheap to begin with.
Good question there. Glad we covered that. One more question for you, Ben Inker, and then I want to go on to some companies reporting earnings this week. Active managers have had a tough time beating the equity benchmarks in the US and globally. What makes this such a difficult market for traditional active management, and what's the longer term outlook?
Yeah. So this is a question we have been getting a ton from our institutional clients. They're looking back at the returns of their active managers, particularly in the US, and they're saying, my God, they have done really badly relative to the index for like a decade. Is there something just wrong? Has the US market gotten too efficient to bother to try to do active management in? And as we've looked at what's gone on in the US, the reality is something a little bit different. It's not that the U.S. market has been efficient. It's that the group of stocks that has won has been a group that active managers are systematically underweight. So over the last decade, the largest 10 names in the S&P 500 have outperformed the market by, depending on how you want to think about it, about 5 points a year. So it's not just that those companies are big, they're big and they have been winning. And that's a problem for active managers, because if you want to own the stocks you like, you have to be underweight something. And it turns out it is almost impossible as an active manager to really be able to own enough of the stuff you really like without being underweight the very largest names. So in periods when the very largest names outperform, active managers lose. In periods where the very largest names underperform, and at times they do, active managers outperform and look really smart. So over the last decade, as I was saying, the large cap names have won. And one of the ways you can see that is there's been a lot of outperformance by the capitalization weighted S&P, which is the normal way we think about that index, versus the equally weighted S&P, where you just have 0.2% of your portfolio in each of the 500 names. Over the last decade, again, that equally weighted version has really underperformed. From 2000 to 2005, by contrast, that equally weighted S&P beat the standard S&P by 10 points a year for 5 years. So it can go the other way. Now, what does this mean looking forward? Well, the difficulty of a situation where 30% of the index is seven names is individual names are hard to predict. Mm-hmm. It is possible that NVIDIA will continue to go up massively for a significant period of time. But we do see that the very largest names, in addition to being much larger than they normally are trading at a bigger premium to the market than they normally do. Historically, that has been a bad sign for them. When that weight gets high and that valuation premium gets big, in previous times when that happened, we saw that in 73 and into the beginning of 1974. We saw that in 99 and 2000. Those were both really bad times to own the big caps relative to a more equally weighted portfolio. If history's a guide, probably the next decade will be friendlier to both kind of the equally weighted version of the index. And whenever that happens, active managers tend to look a lot better.
This is a pretty positive story you're telling for the active management crowd.
Now, I will say you don't have to hire an active manager. You could just own the equally weighted S&P.
Right.
My guess is it's probably going to beat the cap weighted S&P over the next decade. And even if you look back as far as we possibly can, right, over the last 100 years, the equally weighted S&P has beaten the cap weighted S&P. So it's not a bad bias to have. It's one that would be impossible for everyone to have at the same time, but that's right. Not your problem as an investor.
Right, that's for sure. So thank you so much for those comments. I want to move on quickly to some earnings announcements this week, and then we'll come back to listener questions, which are pouring in. So Ben Levison, I'm going to ask you to take it from here. We finally had some good news today from a prominent U.S. bank. I'm talking about Goldman Sachs. It nicely beat consensus earnings estimates. So tell us what the good news is there. What drove results? What does it mean for the longer term for Goldman?
Sure. So Goldman came out, they reported a profit of $11.58 a share. That was 32% higher than the consensus for $8.79 a share, and even better than most of the bullish estimates that were out
there. That is a stunning overshoot.
Yeah, it's a big beat. What was great about it is that they did their return on tangible equity came in at 15.9%. JP Morgan's analysts point out that this is the best quarter for that metric since the first quarter of 2022. So that's about 2 years. Their fixed income, currency, and commodities trading revenues were up 10%. That compares to the money center banks, which were down 7 to 10% so far. And the equities trading was also very strong. And they're also, Goldman also just showed that it was doing a great job with the capital markets and with the M&A kind of activity and whatnot. And the other thing is that there was just a lot fewer, we had a lot of these one-off items as Goldman slowly got out of this retail bet that it had made. And there wasn't much of that this time around. And so you ended up with some numbers that were very clean and very strong. And it really, for one quarter at least, looks like Goldman being Goldman, kind of the traditional way you think of the bank.
And very good news, I would imagine, for the CEO, David Solomon.
Yeah, you'd have to think that this takes some of the pressure off of him that he'd been under just by the underperformance recently.
So how do you interpret Goldman's results in light of the generally disappointing results from JP Morgan, Wells Fargo, and some of the other big banks?
I think a lot of this is just like you look at JP Morgan and the numbers weren't bad. It's just the stock has outperformed pretty much every other bank stock this time around, and the numbers disappointed a bit. And so it dropped. It also happened to report on this day that the market was kind of freaking out about what was happening in the Middle East. And so it's hard to separate both like how much of this was earnings and how much was other things that were weighing on it. But JP Morgan, I think it's one of those cases where it's just sometimes you've been so strong that there's very little you could do that would get the stock going up again. Wells Fargo actually held up pretty well on Friday, and you're seeing that one is still a kind of a self-help story, trying to get out from under this asset cap. When that happens, that's probably going to be a big deal. And Citigroup is also the same kind of thing, where it's shrinking. It's trying to get out of these businesses that have underperformed for so long and focus on works well. So I think, it's hard to look at Goldman as anything more than Goldman, because so many of these stories are very idiosyncratic at this point.
That's fair enough. So speaking of idiosyncratic, let's take a look at Morgan Stanley. The company reports tomorrow. The stock has done approximately nothing over the past year, and now there are some regulatory inquiries. Tell us what's expected when the company reports.
Yeah, I find this kind of amusing, because if a year ago, it was Morgan Stanley that was sitting on top of the world, and it was Goldman that was really under so much pressure. And now I think people are wondering what's next for Morgan Stanley. James Gorman has stepped down. They have a new CEO. The business has changed a lot. There's a lot more of the wealth management now. And the stock, I think, is just trying to figure out what is it at this point. So right now, it's expected to report a profit of $1.72 when it reports tomorrow. That's going to come, $1.67 when it reports. It's going to have its investment banking business. It has its trading business, and they should probably do well. But the focus will be on wealth management, and where you could have, some of these sweep balances could put pressure on things. They're going to want to see if there is any growth in that area. But that area is actually, as you pointed out, has become kind of an issue.
All right. What do you expect next, given all the regulatory investigations?
Well, I mean, that was the big thing. So the Wall Street Journal last week, and this was just the latest of these reports, their multiple regulators are looking at that asset management business over, it's really over lax money laundering rules. And, we don't know what's going to happen there. Again, this is all reports. Morgan Stanley hasn't said anything. They will be asked about it on the call.
Yes, no doubt.
And they probably won't be able to say anything. I think one analyst, I can't remember which one, was saying that he probably won't say anything beyond that we are cooperating with regulators. But I think that, again, this is the area that was supposed to be the growth. Everybody was saying, this was such a smart move to get into the wealth management business, to place this big bet here. It's really what differentiated Morgan Stanley from its competitors. And now it's becoming a bit of an issue. Until that's worked out, the stock, I think, could underperform a bit.
As it has. That makes sense. So let's get out of banking for a moment and talk about Netflix, which is the name to beat in streaming, certainly. The stock is up 84% over 12 months. The company reports on Thursday. What will be broadcast there, or streamed, I should say?
Yeah, our Paul LaMonica had as part of the Trader column this past weekend, wrote about Netflix and just how, it used to be that the fangs were the big deal. And then that sort of fell to the wayside when everyone kind of soured on Netflix. But he was basically saying that if you're going to talk about Magnificent Seven, you should really have a Magnificent Eight and include Netflix in that group, because it has really been this huge beneficiary of what's been going on in streaming. Everybody else is struggling. They're struggling for profitability. Netflix, has really cracked down on the account sharing. That's helped a lot. The business is more profitable now. It's expected to have a profit of $4.51. That'd be up from $2.88, which is quite a jump there. And it's really doesn't have to worry about these legacy issues that are causing so much consternation for everyone else. I think, as with all these stocks, when you have a stock that's up 84% in 12 months, just 27% in the last 3 months, you have to worry a little bit about the possibility that the results, no matter how good they are going to disappoint. There is some, UBS was saying that they could expect some second quarter commentary to suggest slower subscriber growth. If that's the case, maybe that disappoints people, but we'll have to see how the market reacts.
Still the name to watch in streaming. So let's move on to United Health. The company is deeply involved in the Medicare Advantage market. That market has had some turmoil in the past year. The company reports on Tuesday. What's the outlook there?
Well, this is an interesting one because it's become a real battleground stock. And I think that a lot of it is like the earnings are almost secondary here. It's supposed to report a profit of $6.61 a share. That'd be up from $6.26. Sales would be $99.2 billion. That's up from $91.9. So, you know, good growth there. But this is really about what's happening with the managed care business. And the stock had, you know, dropped on 6.4% on March 2nd when CMS came out and left its proposal for what it was going to pay unchanged. This hit all these stocks. Humana has been hit very hard. Deutsche Bank, one of their desk traders, these are guys who sort of provide trading commentary. It's not research, but was just writing about the debate going on that, you know, the firm's analyst is very bullish on it. He thinks that there's going to be some a relief rally coming. But he was talking about what the bulls and the bears are arguing. And for the bears, they're saying, you know, and I kind of wonder what the answer to this question is, but they're saying what can possibly make this stock go up? And they pointed out that, you know, if you thought back to 15 years ago, you know, these kind of stocks were not trading at premium valuations. You know, the UNH started this year at around 20 times. But 15 years ago, these were much lower multiple stocks just because they were much more like utilities rather than growth stocks. And if you're a bear, that's your argument, is that these stocks are going to go back to being kind of a utility stock where it was trading, UNH was trading at 10 times earnings back in, let's say, 2012. And it's at 15 and a half now. It'll be interesting to see where that multiple settles out and how they convince investors that they're still able to grow. They're still kind of a quality growth stock.
Was a great growth story for a long time.
For a very long time.
So something we will be following and we'll have more to say about. Thank you for that rundown, Ben. I want to get to some listener questions because we have a lot of them today. I'm going to start with one for Ben Anker. It's from Robert, who says, asset allocation is such a puzzle, and I think that's true. How do you divide among sectors? Do you have a particular allocation at all times to, say, equities, bonds, alternatives, et cetera, or is it dynamic? Tell us how you do it.
Well, for us, it is definitely dynamic. What we want to do is first see how much we're getting paid for taking risk. How cheap are stocks relative to bonds and cash? And the cheaper they look, the more we want to own. And the more expensive they look, the less we want to own. Now, that sounds very simple. It is somewhat tricky, though, when you recognize the fact that, look, stocks deliver something like, let's say, 3 to 4 points a year on average more than bonds. And they should, because they are risky. They tend to lose money at bad times for investors. But that means even if stocks are moderately expensive, they're still priced to win. They're still priced to beat bonds and cash just by less. So it is a slightly tricky problem of, well, how expensive do stocks have to be in order to say, I want to own less of them than normal? Or on the flip side, how cheap do they have to get before I decide I'm prepared to take significantly more risk than I normally would on them? We spent a lot of time agonizing over those questions. We haven't fully gotten them right. But I do think, you know, there is really something to be said for making sure you have a diversified portfolio and you own some stocks and some bonds at all times. The question of how dynamic you want to be, some of it comes down to how much of your time and effort do you want to be devoting to your investment portfolio?
Fair enough. And in your case, of course, 100% of your professional time, but for the average investor, maybe something different. In a related question, Rick asks, is asset allocation best done on a schedule or variable related to business cycle or in response to events? It's kind of the same question, but phrased a bit differently.
Yeah, I'd say one of the things about asset allocation, if you're moving your money between bonds and stocks or between bonds and cash, there are some trading costs to that, and there are some tax implications to that. So you don't want to be doing it every day. You'll just trade more than you need to. you don't want to let it get way out of line. You know, if stocks have a great year and are up 50% and bonds are flat, you now have a lot more in stocks as a percent of your total portfolio than you did at the beginning of the year. Probably at some point you want to pull that back. We would say for kind of individual investors, you want to be rebalancing your portfolio at a minimum on a yearly basis. And we think it makes sense to also think in terms of how far out of line from your target asset allocation have you gotten? Are you substantially higher or lower in stocks than you meant to be? Come up with a range that you're comfortable with. And when it gets outside of that range, move back.
Well, makes sense. Drilling down a bit more specifically, we have a question from Susan about REITs. And she asks, is it a good time to sell REITs and buy bonds or stocks? And I'll just broaden the question to ask you about your real estate allocation.
We are cautious on real estate here. In general, we kind of like REITs in principle. They're pretty simple securities, right? These are companies that basically pay out all of their earnings to you as a dividend. You can think of them as a riskier version of TIPS, right? Because rents should rise with inflation. So in general, their dividends should keep up with inflation. So if you're getting a 4% dividend, maybe you're going to get inflation plus 4 out of them. The tricky thing for them today is REITs do have a significant amount of debt. And over time, more and more of that debt is going to come due and they're going to have to refinance it. And we are worried about a bunch of these companies' ability to refinance at rates they can afford. So, I mean, lots of people have been talking about the problems in commercial real estate. Obviously, if you own REITs, you own commercial real estate. It is not our favorite asset class today. We don't think the valuations of the REITs are so low that you are getting paid a lot for taking that risk. Maybe things work out okay for these guys. Maybe the rates come down strongly in 2025 and they are able to refinance just in the nick of time. But they get us nervous.
Does that go for some of the private REITs as well as the public ones?
Oh, man, the private REITs, I don't really understand, to be honest.
Honest answer.
the idea that these investments did not go down in price when interest rates went up a whole lot. That doesn't make much sense to us. And obviously a lot of these things have now gotten gated. I don't know. I am not an expert on these private REITs, but I'm much more comfortable trying to understand the valuations of the public REITs than the non-publicly traded ones.
Well, I'm glad that the question was asked about real estate, certainly. So we have a question about energy, and I don't know which Ben wants to take this one, but maybe we'll give this one to Ben Levison. Would energy stocks be a good hedge against global uncertainty?
It seems that there is a group of people who think so. It does feel that way right now. I think the one thing I would say is that they've kind of had a little bit of a run already, which it would have been nice to be in these, say, from the beginning of March, because they've rallied quite a bit and actually did drop on Friday. They had a pretty nice drop, and today they're actually down a little bit as some of these worries come off. But they are not horribly expensive, and they do seem like a decent, if you're worried about what's happening in the Middle East, they do seem like a decent way to protect against it a bit.
All right, question about treasuries for Ben Inker. Are you bullish on treasuries? And if not, why?
Well, we are content with treasuries today, and we haven't been content with treasuries for a very long time. Today, right, you're getting paid after expected inflation a little bit over 2%. to own either a standard treasury or an inflation adjusted treasury. That strikes us as about fair. And so we think they are a decent thing to own. You're not going to get rich owning them. And this is not the second coming of 1982, which, you know, was the start of a bull rally where people made absurd amounts of money in treasury bonds. But for the first time since the GFC, as we look across the entirety of the treasury curve, it's like, yeah, that's okay. That's not bad. I could own that.
Do you worry at all? I mean, watching the 10-year today, where it, I think it got close to 4.7%. Are you worried about another run to 5% or more?
Well, you know, the nice thing as the yield gets higher, the impact of yields rising gets a little bit less painful because of two things, right? One is the higher the yield of the bond, the lower the duration of the bond. So it's less sensitive to changes in yields. And the other thing is, hey, if the yield goes up to five, at least you are effectively getting paid 4.7% along the way. So if you knew the bond was going to go up to a 5% yield, of course, don't buy it here. But it wouldn't be the end of the world if it did from now. Whereas if we were sitting back in, 2021, when, you know, the bond was yielding, 70 basis points or 0.7%, if it went from 0.7% to 1%, that was kind of a disaster.
So not the end of the world and comfortable in treasuries. Those are my takeaways here. All right. Unfortunately, we have to end it there today. But thank you for a great call to Two Smart Bens. Very glad to have you on the call today. And thank you to our listeners for your terrific questions. We had a bunch of questions about energy, and we'll come back to that subject in coming weeks. Please join us again next Monday on Barron's Live. My guest will be Jeffrey Kolich, a portfolio manager at Barron Capital and manager of the Barron Real Estate Income Fund. Our listeners have also had a lot of questions about real estate in recent weeks. We listened and we found an expert to talk to you. So do tune in next Monday. Thanks again, everybody. Stay well and have a good week.